Side 7. A Fire Up on the Deep by Werner Vinge. Continuing on page 145. That was the public's view of Vendacious. Anyone who understood the ways of security would also guess that the Chamberlain managed Woodcarver's spies. No doubt he had dozens of informants in the mills and on the docks. But now Scriber knew that even that was just a cover. Imagine having agents in the Flenserist inner circle, knowing the Flenserist plans, their fears, their weaknesses, and being able to manipulate them. Vendacious was simply incredible. Ruefully, Scriber must acknowledge the other's stark genius. And yet, this knowledge did not guarantee victory. Not all the Flenserist schemes could be directly managed from the top. Some of the enemy's low-level operations might proceed unknown and quite successfully. And it would only take a single arrow to totally kill Johanna Orschendott. Here was where Scriber Jacques Ramathan could prove his value. He asked to move into the castle curtain on the third floor. No problem getting permission. His new quarters were smaller, the walls rudely quilted. A single arrow loop gave an uninspired view across the castle grounds. For Scriber's new purpose, the room was perfect. Over the next few days, he took to lurking in the promenades. The main walls were laced with tunnels, 15 inches wide by 30 tall. Scriber could get almost anywhere in the curtain without being seen from outside. He padded single file from one tunnel to the next, emerging for a few moments on a rampart to flit from Merlin to embrasure to Merlin, a head poking out here, a head poking out there. Of course he ran into guards, but Jacques Ramathan was cleared to be in the walls. And he had studied the guards' routine. They knew he was around, but Scriber was confident they had no idea of the extent of his effort. It was hard, cold work, but worth the effort. Scriber's great goal in life was to do something spectacular and valuable. The problem was, most of his ideas were so deep that other packs, even people he respected immensely, didn't understand. That had been the problem with Johanna. Well, after a few more days, he could go to Vendacious, and then... As he peeked around corners and through arrow slots, two of Scriber's members huddled down, taking notes. After 10 days, he had enough to impress even Vendacious. Vendacious's official residence was surrounded by rooms for assistants and guards. It was not the place to make a secret offer. Besides, Scriber had had bad luck with the direct approach before. You could wait days for an appointment, and the more patient you were, the more you followed the rules, the more the bureaucrats considered you a non-entity. But Vendacious was sometimes alone. There was this turret on the old wall on the forest side of the castle. Late on the 11th day of his investigation, Scriber stationed himself on that turret and waited. An hour passed. The wind eased. Heavy fog washed in from the harbor. It oozed up the old wall like slow-moving sea foam. Everything became very, very quiet, the way it always does in a thick fog. Scriber nosed moodily around the turret platform. It really was decrepit. The mortar crumbled under his claws. It felt like you could pull some of the stones right out of the wall. Damn. Maybe Vendacious was going to break the pattern and not come up here today. But Scriber waited another 30 minutes, and his patience paid off. He heard the click of steel on the spiral stairs. There was no sound of thought. It was just too foggy for that. A minute passed. The trapdoor popped up, and a head stuck through. Even in the fog, Vendacious's surprise was a fierce hiss. "Peace, sir. It is only I, loyal Jacques Ramathan." The head came further out. "What would a loyal citizen be doing up here?" "Why, I am here to see you," Scriber said, laughing. "At this, your secret office. Come on up, sir. With this fog, there is enough room for both of us." One after another, Vendacious's members hoisted themselves through the trapdoor. Some barely made it. their knives and jewelry catching on the doorframe. Vendacious was not the slimmest of packs. The security chief ranged himself along the far side of the turret, a posture that bespoke suspicion. He was nothing like the pompous, patronizing pack of their public encounters. Scriber grinned to himself. He certainly had the other's attention.
"Well?"
Vendacious said in a flat voice. "Sir, I wish to offer my services. I believe that my very presence here shows I can be of value to Woodcarver's security. Who but a talented professional could have determined that you used this place as your secret den?"
Vendacious seemed to untense a little. He smiled wryly.
"Who indeed? I come here precisely because this part of the old wall can't be seen from anywhere in the castle. Here I can commune with the hills and be free of bureaucratic trivia."
Jacques Ramathan nodded. "I understand, sir, but you are wrong in one detail." He pointed past the security chief. "You can't see it through all this fog, but on the harbor side of the castle there is a single spot that has a line of sight on your turret."
"So? Who could see much from..."
"Ah, the eye tools you brought from the Republic."
"Exactly." Scriber reached into a pocket and brought out a telescope. "Even from across the yard I could recognize you." The eye tools could have made Scriber famous. Woodcarver and Scrupolo had been enchanted by them. Unfortunately, honesty had required him to admit that he bought the devices from an inventor and Rangathir. Never mind that it was he who recognized the value of the invention, that it was he who used it to help rescue Johanna. When they discovered that he did not know quite how the lenses worked, they had accepted his gift of one and turned to their own glass makers. Oh, well, he was still the best eye tool user in this part of the world.
"It's not just you I've been watching, my lord. That's been the smallest part of my investigation. Over the last 10 days, I've spent many hours on the castle walks."
Vendacious's lips quirked.
"Indeed."
"I dare say not many noticed me, and I was very careful that no one saw me using the eye tool. In any case..."
He pulled his book from another pocket.
"I've compiled extensive notes. I know who goes where and when during almost all the hours of light. You can imagine the power of my technique during the summer."
He set the book on the floor and slid it toward Vendacious. After a moment, the other reached a member forward and dragged it toward himself. He didn't seem very enthusiastic.
"Please understand, sir, I know that you tell Woodcarver what goes on in the highest Flenser councils. Without your sources, we would be helpless against those lords, but..."
"Who told you such things?"
Scriber gulped.
"Brazen it out."
He grinned weakly.
"No one had to tell me. I'm a professional like yourself, and I know how to keep a secret. But think, there might be others of my ability within the castle, and some might be traitors. You might never hear of them from your high-placed sources. Think of the damage they could do. You need my help. With my approach, you can keep track of everyone. I would be happy to train a corps of investigators. We could even operate in the city, watching from the market towers."
The security chief sidled around the parapet. He kicked idly at stones in the rotted mortar.
"The idea has its attractions. Mind you, I think we have all Flenser's agents identified. We feed them well. With lies. It's interesting to hear the lies come back from our sources up there."
He laughed shortly and glanced over the parapet, thinking.
"But you're right. If we are missing anyone with access to the two legs or data set, it could be disastrous."
He turned more heads at Scriber.
"You've got a deal. I can get you 4 or 5 people to, train in your methods."
Scriber couldn't control his expression. He almost bounced in enthusiasm, all eyes on Vendacious.
"You won't regret this, sir."
Vendacious shrugged.
"Probably not. Now, how many others have you told about your investigation? We'll want to bring them in, swear them to secrecy."
Scriber drew himself up.
My lord, I told you that I am a professional. I have kept this completely to myself, waiting for this conversation.
Vendacious smiled and relaxed to an almost genial posture.
Excellent. Then we can begin.
Maybe it was Vendacious's voice, a trifle too loud, or maybe it was some small sound behind him. Whatever the reason, Scriber turned a head from the other and saw swift shadows coming over the forest side of the parapet. Too late, he heard the attacker's mind noise. Arrows hissed and fire burned through his fan's throat. He gagged, but kept himself together and raced around the turret toward Vendacious.
Help me!
The scream was a waste of speech. Scriber knew, even before the other drew his knives and backed away. Vendacious stood clear as his assassin jumped into Scriber's midst. Rational thought dimmed in a frenzy of noise and slashing pain.
Tell Peregrine! Tell Johanna!
The butchering continued for timeless instants, and then... Part of him was drowning in sticky red. Part of him was blinded. Jacques Rama's thought came in ragged fragments. At least one of him was dead. Fan lay beheaded in a spreading pool of blood. It steamed in the cold air. Pain and cold and... drowning, choking.
Tell Johanna.
The assassin and his boss had retreated from him. Vendacious. Security chief. Traitor in chief.
Tell Johanna.
They stood quietly, watching him bleed to death. Too prissy to mess their thoughts with his. They'd wait, till his mind noise dimmed, then finish the job. Quiet. So quiet. The killer's distant thoughts. Sounds of gagging, moaning. No one would ever know. Almost all gone. Ja stared dumbly at the two strange packs. One came toward him, steel claws on its feet, blades in its mouth.
No!
Ja jumped up, slipping and skidding on the wet. The pack lunged, but Ja was already standing on the parapet. He leaped backwards and fell and fell. And shattered on rocks far below. Ja pulled himself away from the wall. There was pain across his back, then numbness. Where am I? Where am I? Fog everywhere. High above him there were muttering voices. Memories of knives and tines floated in his small mind, all jumbled.
Tell Johanna.
He remembered. Something from before. A hidden trail through deep brush. If he went that way far enough, he would find Johanna. Ja dragged himself slowly up the path. Something was wrong with his rear legs. He couldn't feel them. Tell Johanna. Chapter 19. Johanna coughed. Things just seemed to go from bad to worse around here. She'd had a sore throat and sniffles the last 3 days. She didn't know whether to be frightened or not. Diseases were an everyday thing in medieval times. Yeah. And lots of people died of them, too. She wiped her nose and tried to concentrate on what Woodcarver was saying.
Scrupolo has already made some gunpowder. It works just as Dataset predicted. Unfortunately, he nearly lost a member trying to use it in a wooden cannon. If we can't make cannon, I'm afraid...
A week ago, Woodcarver wouldn't have been welcome here. All their meetings had been down in the castle halls. But then Johanna got sick. It was a cold, she was sure, and hadn't felt like running around out of doors. Besides, Scriber's visit had kind of shamed her. Some of the packs were decent enough. She had decided to try and get along with Woodcarver, and Pompous Clown, too, if he'd ever come around again. As long as creatures like Scarbutt stayed out of her way. Johanna leaned a little closer to the fire and waved away Woodcarver's objections. Sometimes this pack seemed like her eldest grandmother.
Assume we can make them. We have lots of time till summer. Tell Scrupolo to study the data set more carefully and quit trying shortcuts. The question is how to use them to rescue my starship.
Woodcarver brightened. The drooler broke off, wiping its muzzle to join the others in a head bob.
I've talked about this with Peregrine, with several people, especially Vendacious.
Ordinarily, getting an army to Hidden Island would be a terrible problem. Going by sea is fast, but there are some deadly choke points along the way. Going through the forest is slow, and the other side would have plenty of warning. But great good luck. Vendacious has found some safe trails. We may be able to sneak.
Someone was scratching at the door. Woodcarver cocked a pair of heads.
That's strange, she said.
Why?
Johanna asked absently. She hiked the quilt around her shoulders and stood. Two of Woodcarver went with her to the door. Johanna opened the door and looked into the fog. Suddenly, Woodcarver was talking loudly, all gobble. Their visitor had retreated. Something was strange, and for an instant, she couldn't figure what it was. This was the first time she had seen a dog thing all by itself. The point barely registered when most of Woodcarver spilled past her out the doorway. Then Johanna's servant, up in the loft, began screaming. The sound jabbed pain through Johanna's ears. The lone tine twisted awkwardly on its rear and tried to drag itself away, but Woodcarver had it surrounded. She shouted something, and the screeching in the loft stopped. There was the thump of paws on wooden stairs, and the servant bounded into the open, its crossbows cocked. From down the hill, she heard the rattle of weapons as guards raced toward them. Johanna ran to Woodcarver, ready to add her fists to any defense. But the pack was nuzzling the stranger, licking its neck. After a moment, Woodcarver caught the tine by its jacket.
Help me carry him inside, Johanna, please.
The girl lifted the tine's flanks. The fur was damp with mist and sticky with blood. Then they were through the doorway and laying the member on a pillow by the fire. The creature was making that breathy whistling, the sound of ultimate pain. It looked up at her, its eyes so wide she could see the white all around. For an instant, she thought it was terrified of her. But when she stepped back, it just made the sound louder and stretched its neck toward her. She knelt beside the pillow. It lay its muzzle on her hand.
But what is it?
She looked back along its body, past the padded jacket. The tine's haunches were twisted at an odd angle, one-legged dangling near the fire.
"Don't you know," began Woodcarver, "this is part of Jacques Ramaphan."
She pushed a nose under the dangling leg and raised it onto the pillow. There was loud talk between the guards and Johanna's servant. Through the door she saw members holding torches. They rested their forepaws on their fellow's shoulders and held the lights high. No one tried to come in. There'd be no room. Johanna looked back at the injured tine.
Scriber?
Then she recognized the jacket. The creature looked back at her, still wheezing its pain.
Can't you get a doctor?
Woodcarver was all around her. She answered,
I am a doctor, Johanna.
She nodded at the data set and continued softly. At least, what passes for one here? Johanna wiped blood from the creature's neck. More kept oozing.
Well, can you save him? This fragment, maybe, but...
One of Woodcarver went to the door and talked to the packs beyond.
My people are searching for the rest of him. I think he is mostly murdered, Johanna. If there were others, well, even fragments stick together.
Has he said anything?
It was another voice, speaking Somnorsh. Scarbutt. His big ugly snout was stuck through the doorway.
No, said Woodcarver. And his mind noise is a complete jumble.
Let me listen to him, said Scarbutt.
You stay back, you!
Johanna's voice was a scream. The creature in her arms twitched.
Johanna, this is Scriber's friend. Let him help.
As the Scarbutt pack sidled into the room, Woodcarver climbed into the loft, giving him room. Johanna eased her arm from under the injured tine and backed away, ending up at the doorway herself. There were lots more packs outside than she had imagined, and they were standing closer than she had ever seen. Their torches glowed like soft fluorescence in the foggy dark. Her gaze snapped back to the fire pit.
"I'm watching you."
Scarbutt's members clustered around the pillow. The big one lay its head next to the injured tines. For a moment, the tine continued its breathy whistling. Scarbutt gobbled at it. The reply was a steady warbling, almost beautiful. From up in the loft, Woodcarver said something. She and Scarbutt talked back and forth.
"Well," said Johanna. "Ja, the fragment, is not a talker," came Woodcarver's voice.
"Worse," said Scarbutt. "For now, at least, I can't match his mind sounds. I'm not getting sense or image from him. I can't tell who murdered Scriber."
Johanna stepped back into the room and walked slowly to the pillow. Scarbutt moved aside, but did not leave the wounded tine. She knelt between two of him and petted the long, bloodied neck.
"Will Ja," she spoke the sound as best she could, "live?"
Scarbutt ran three noses down the length of the body. They pressed gently at the wounds. Ja twisted and whistled, except when Scarbutt pressed his haunches.
"I don't know. Most of this blood is just splatter, probably from the other members. But his spine is broken. Even if the fragment lives, he'll have only two usable legs."
Johanna thought for a moment, trying to see things from a tinish perspective. She didn't like the view. It might not make sense, but to her, this Ja was still Scriber. To Scarbutt, the creature was a fragment, an organ from a fresh corpse, a damaged one at that. She looked at Scarbutt, at the big killer member.
"So what does your kind do with such garbage?"
Three of his heads turned toward her, and she could see his hackles rise. His synthetic voice became high-pitched and staccato.
"Scriber was a good friend. We could build a two-wheel cart for Ja's rear. He'd be able to move around some. The hard part will be finding a pack for him. You know we're looking for other fragments. We may be able to patch something up. If not, well, I have only four members. I will try to adopt him."
As he spoke, one head patted the wounded member.
"I'm not sure it will work. Scriber was not a loose-souled person, not in any way a pilgrim, and right now I don't match him at all."
Johanna slumped back. Scarbutt wasn't responsible for everything that went wrong in the universe.
"Woodcarver has excellent brood kenners. Maybe some other match can be found. But understand, it's hard for adult members to re-merge, especially non-talkers. Single fragments, like Ja, often die of their own accord. They just stop eating. Or sometimes, go down to the harbor sometime, look at the workers. You'll see some big packs there. But with the minds of idiots, they can't hold together. The smallest problem, and they run in all directions. That's how the unlucky repacks end."
Scarbutt's voice traded back and forth between two of his members and dribbled into silence. All his heads turned to Ja. The member had closed his eyes. Sleeping? He was still breathing, but it sounded kind of burbly. Johanna looked across the room at the trap door to the loft. Woodcarver had stuck a single head down through the hole. The upside-down face looked back at Johanna. Another time, her appearance would have been comical.
"Unless a miracle happens, Scriber died today. Understand that, Johanna. But if the fragment lives, even a short time, we'll likely find the murderer." "How if he can't communicate?"
"Yes, but he can still show us. I've ordered Vendicius's men to confine the staff to quarters. When Ja is calmer, we'll march every pack in the castle past him. The fragment certainly remembers what happened to Scriber and wants to tell us. If any of the killers are our own people, he'll see them.
And he'll make a fuss.
Just like a dog."
"Right.
So the main thing is to provide him with security right now, and hope our doctors can save him."
They found the rest of Scriber a couple of hours later on a turret of the old wall. Vendacious said it looked like one or two packs had come out of the forest and climbed the turret, perhaps in an attempt to see under the grounds. It had all the markings of an incompetent first-time probe. Nothing of value could be seen from that turret, even on a clear day. But for Scriber, it had been fatally bad luck. Apparently, he had surprised the intruders. Five of his members had been variously arrowed, hacked, decapitated. The sixth, Ja, had broken his back on the sloping stonework at the base of the wall. Johanna walked out to the turret the next day. Even from the ground, she could see brownish stains on the parapet. She was glad she couldn't go to the top. Ja died during the night, though not from any further enemy action. He was under Vendacious's protection the whole time. Johanna went the next few days without saying much. At night she cried a little. God damn their doctoring. A broken back they could diagnose, but hidden injuries, internal bleeding, of such they were completely ignorant. Apparently Woodcarver was famous for her theory that the heart pumped the blood around the body. Give her another 1,000 years and maybe she could do better than a butcher. For a while she hated them all. Scarbutt for all the old reasons, Woodcarver for her ignorance, Vendacious for letting Flenserists get so close to the castle, and Johanna Olschendott for rejecting Scriber when he had tried to be a friend. What would Scriber say now? He had wanted her to trust them. He said that Scarbutt and the others were good people. One night, about a week later, she came close to making peace with herself. She was lying on her pallet, the quilt heavy and warm upon her. The designs painted on the walls glimmered dim in the ember light. All right, Scriber. For you, I will trust them. Chapter 20. Fom Nguyen remembered almost nothing of the first days after dying, after the pain of the old one's ending. Ghostly figures, anonymous words. Someone said he'd been kept alive in the ship's surgeon. He remembered none of it. Why they kept the body breathing was a mystery and an affront. Eventually, the animal reflexes had revived. The body began breathing of its own accord. The eyes opened. No brain damage. Greenstalk, said, a full recovery. The husk that had been a living being spoke no contradiction. What was left of Fom Nguyen spent a lot of time on the OOB's bridge. From before, the ship reminded him of a fat sow bug. The bugs had been common in the straw laid across the floor of the great hall of his father's castle on Canberra. The little kids had played with them. The critters didn't have real legs, just a dozen feathery spines sticking out from a chitinous thorax. No matter how you tumbled them, those spines' antennas would twitch the bug around, and it would scuttle on its way, unmindful that it might be upside down from before. Yes, the OOB's ultra-drive spines looked a lot like a sow bug's, though not as articulated, and the body itself was fat and sleek, slightly narrowed in the middle. So Fom Nguyen had ended inside of a sow bug. How fitting for a dead man. And now he sat on the bridge. The woman brought him here often. She seemed to know it should fascinate him. The walls were displays better than he had ever seen in merchantman days. When the windows looked out the ship's exterior cameras, the view was as good as from any crystal canopy bridge in the Cheng Ho fleet. It was like something out of the crudest fantasy or a graphics simulation. If he sat long enough, he could actually see the stars move in the sky. The ship was doing about 10 ultra jumps per second. Jump, recompute, and jump again. In this part of the beyond, they could go 1,000th of a light year on each jump. Farther, but then the recompute time would be substantially worse. At 10 per second, that added up to more than 30 light-years per hour. The jumps themselves were imperceptible to human senses, and between the jumps they were in free fall, carrying the same intrinsic velocity they'd had on departing relay. So there was none of the Doppler shifting of relativistic flight. The stars were as pure as seen from some desert sky or in low-speed transit. Without any fuss, they simply slid across the sky, the closer ones, the faster. In half an hour, he went farther than he had in half a century with the Cheng Ho. Greenstalk drifted onto the bridge one day and began changing the windows. As usual, she spoke to Pham as she did so, chatting almost as if there were a real person here to listen.
"See, the center window is an ultra-wave map of the region directly behind us."
Greenstalk waved a tendril over the controls. The multicolored pictures appeared on the other walls.
"Similarly, for the other 5 points of direction."
The words were noise in Fom's ears, understood but of no interest. The rider paused, then continued with something like the futile persistence of the Ravna woman.
"When ships make a jump, when they re-enter, there's a kind of an ultra-wave splash. I'm checking if we're being followed."
Colors on the windows all around, even in front of Fom's eyes. There were smooth gradations, no bright spots, no linear features.
I know, she said, making up both sides of the conversation. The ship's analyzers are still massaging the data. But if anyone's pacing us closer than 100 light-years, we'll see them. And if they're farther than that, well, then they probably can't detect us.
It doesn't matter. Pham almost shut the question out of his mind, but there were no stars to look at. He stared at the glowing colors and actually thought about the problem. Thought. A joke. No one down here ever really thought about anything. Perhaps 10,000 starships had escaped the fall of Relay. Most likely the enemy had not catalogued those departures. The attack on Relay had been a minor adjunct to the murder of Oldwin. Most likely the OOB had escaped unnoticed. Why should the enemy care where the last of Oldwin's memories might be hiding? Why should it care about where their little ship might be bound? A tremor passed through his body. Animal reflex, surely. Panic was slowly rising in Ravna Bergschendott. Every day a little stronger. It was not any particular disaster, just the slow dying of hope. She tried to be near Pham Nguyen part of every day, to talk to him, to hold his hand. He never responded, not even, except perhaps by accident, to look at her. Greenstalk tried, too. Alien though Greenstalk was, the Pham of before had seemed truly attracted to the riders. He was off all medical support now, but he might as well have been a vegetable. And all the while their descent was slowing, always a little worse than what Blueshell had predicted. And when she turned to the news, in some ways that was the most horrifying of all. The death race theory was getting popular. More and more there were folk who seemed to think that the human race was spreading the blight. Crypto Zero, as received by OOB Shipboard Ad Hoc. Language Path, Bailoresque to Trisqueline, SJK units. From Alliance for the Defense. Claimed cooperative of 5 polyspecific empires in the beyond below Straumli realm. No record of existence before the fall of the realm. Subject, Blighter Video Thread. Distribution, Threat of the Blight, War Trackers Interest Group, Homo Sapiens Interest Group. Date, 17.95 days since fall of Relay. Text of message. So far, we've processed 500,000 messages about this creature's video and read a goodly fraction of them. Most of you are missing the point. The principle of the helper's operation is clear. This is a transcendent power using ultralight communication to operate through a race in the beyond. It would be fairly easy to do in the transcend. There are a number of stories about thralls of powers there. But for such communication to be effective within the beyond, truly extensive design changes must be made in the minds of the controlled race. It could not have happened naturally, and it cannot be quickly done to new races, no matter what the blight says. We've watched the Homo sapiens interest group since the first appearance of the blight. Where is this Earth the humans claim to be from? Halfway around the galaxy, they say, and deep in the slow zone. Even their proximate origin, Nuyora, is conveniently in the slowness. We see an alternative theory. Sometime, maybe further back than the last consistent archives, there was a battle between powers. The blueprint for this human race was written, complete with communication interfaces. Long after the original contestants and their stories had vanished, this race happened to get in position where it could transcend. And that transcending was tailor-made, too, re-establishing the power that had set the trap to begin with. We're not sure of the details, but a scenario such as this is inevitable. What we must do is also clear. Stromley Rome is at the heart of the Blight, obviously beyond all attack. But there are other human colonies. We ask the Net to help in identifying all of them. We ourselves are not a large civilization, but we would be happy to coordinate the information gathering and the military action that is required to prevent the Blight spread in the middle beyond. For nearly 17 weeks, we've been calling for action. Had you listened in the beginning, a concerted strike might have been sufficient to destroy the Stromley realm. Isn't the fall of Relay enough to wake you up? Friends, if we act together, we still have a chance. Death to vermin. The bastards even played on humanity's foundling nature. Foundling races were rare, but scarcely unknown. Now these death-to-vermin creatures were turning the miracle of Nuyora into something deadly evil. Death-to-vermin were the only ones to call for pogroms, but even respected posters were saying things that indirectly might support such action. Crypto Zero, as received by OOB Shipboard Ad Hoc, Language Path, Trisqueline SJK Units. From Shandor Arbitration Intelligence at the Zoo. A known military corporation of the high beyond. If this is a masquerade, somebody is living dangerously. Subject, Blighter Video Thread, Hans Subthread. Key phrases, limits on the blight is searching for something. Distribution. Threat of the blight. Close coupled, automation interest group. War trackers interest group. Date, 11.94 days since fall of Relay. Text of message. The Blight admits that it is a power that teleoperates softens in the beyond. But consider how difficult it is to have a close-coupled automation with time lags of more than a few milliseconds. The known Net is a perfect illustration of this. Lags range between 5 milliseconds for systems that are a couple of light-years apart, to, at least, several hundred seconds when messages must pass through intermediate nodes. This, combined with the low bandwidth available across interstellar distances, makes the known Net a loose forum for the exchange of information and lies. And these restrictions are inherent in the nature of the beyond, part of the same restrictions that make it impossible for the powers to exist down here. We conclude that even the Blight can't attain close-coupled control except in the high beyond. At the top, the Blight's softened agents are literally its limbs. In the middle beyond, we believe mental possession is possible, but that considerable pre-processing must be done in the controlled mind. Furthermore, considerable external equipment, the bulky items characteristic of those depths, is needed to support the communication. Direct, millisecond-by-millisecond control is normally impractical in the middle beyond. Combat at this level would involve hierarchical control. Long-term operations would also use intimidation, fraud, and traitors. These are the threats that you of the middle and low beyond should recognize. These are the Blight's tools in the middle and low beyond, and what you should guard against for the immediate future. We don't see imperial takeovers. There's no profit sustenance in it. Even the destruction of Relay was probably just a byplay to the murder it was simultaneously committing in the Transcend. The greatest tragedies will continue to be at the top and in the low Transcend. But we know that the Blight is searching for something. It has attacked at great distances where major archives were the target. Beware of traitors and spies. Even some of humanity's supporters sent a chill through Ratna. Crypto Zero, as received by OOB Shipboard Ad Hoc, Language Path, Trisqueline SJK Units, from Hans. Subject, Blighter Video Thread, Alliance for the Defense Subthread. Key phrases, Death Race Theory, Distribution, Threat of the Blight, War Trackers Interest Group, Homo Sapiens Interest Group. Date, 18.29 days since fall of Relay. Text of message. I have obtained specimens from the human worlds in our volume. Detailed analysis is available in Homo Sapiens Interest Group Archive. My conclusions. Previous, but less intensive, analysis of human phys-psych is correct. The race has no built-in structures to support remote control. Experiments with living subjects showed no special inclination toward submission. I found little or no evidence of artificial optimization. There was evidence of DNA surgery to improve disease resistance. Drift timing dated the hack work at 2,000 years before present. The blood of Straumli realm subjects carried an Optogen's Theralt, a cheap medical recipe that can be tailored across a wide mammalian range. This race, as represented by my specimens, looks like something that arrived from the slow zone quite recently, probably from a single origin world. Has anyone done such retesting on more distant human worlds? Crypto Zero, as received by OOB Shipboard Ad Hoc, Language Path, Bailoresque, 2 Trisqueline, SJK Units. From Alliance for the Defense. Claimed cooperative of 5 polyspecific empires in the beyond below Straumli realm. No record of existence before the fall of the realm. Subject, Blighter Video Thread, Hans 1. Distribution, Threat of the Blight, War Trackers Interest Group, Homo Sapiens Interest Group. Date, 19.43 days since fall of Relay. Text of message. Who is this Hans? It makes objective, tough-sounding noises about testing human specimens, but it keeps its own nature secret. Don't be fooled by humans telling you about themselves. In fact, we have no way of testing the creatures that dwell in Straumli realm. The Protector will see to that. Death to vermin. And there was a little boy trapped at the bottom of the well. Some days no communication was possible. Other days, when the OOB antenna swarm was tuned in exactly the right direction and when the vagaries of the zone favored it, then Ratna could hear his ship. Even then, the signal was so faint, so distorted, that the effective transmission rate was just a few bits per second. Yefri and his problems might be only the smallest footnote to the story of the Blight, less than that since no one knew of him. But to Ratna Bergshendat, these conversations were the only bright thing in her life just now. The kid was very lonely, but less so now, she thought. She learned about his friend, Omdi, about the stern Tyrethek, and the heroic Mr. Steele, and the proud Tynes. Ratna smiled to herself, at herself. The walls of her cabin displayed a flat mural of jungle. Deep in the drippy murk lay regular shadows, a castle built in the roots of a giant mangrove tree. The mural was a famous one. The original had been an analog work from 2,000 years ago. It showed life at an even further remove, during the Dark Ages on Nuyora. She and Luna had spent much of their childhood imagining that they were transported to such a time. Little Yefri was trapped in the real thing. Woodcarver's butchers were no interstellar threat, but they were a deadly horror to those around them. Thank goodness Yefri had not seen the killings. This was a real medieval world, a tough and unforgiving place, even if Yefri had fallen in with fair-minded people. and the New Yoran comparison was only vaguely appropriate. These tines were pack mines. Even old Grander Kallir had been surprised at that. All through Yefri's mail, Ravna could see the panic among Steele's people. "Mr. Steele asked me again if there's any way we can make our ship to fly even a little. I don't know. We almost crashed, I think. We need guns. That would save us, at least till you get here. They have bows and arrows, just like in New Yoran days, but no guns. He's asking me, can you teach us to make guns?" Woodcarver's raiders would return, and this time in enough force to overrun Steele's little kingdom. Back when they thought OOB's flight would be only 40 days, that had not seemed a great risk, but now Ravna might arrive to find Woodcarver's murdering complete. "Oh, Fom, dear Fom, if you ever really were, please come back now. Fom Nguyen of medieval Canberra. Fom Nguyen, traitor from the slowness. What would someone such as you make of this? Chapter 21. Ravna knew that, under his bluster, Blueshell was at least as much a worrier as she. Worse, he was a nitpicker. The next time Ravna asked him about their progress, he retreated into technicalities. Finally, Ravna broke in. "Look, the kid is sitting on something that just might blow the blight sky high, and all he has are bows and arrows. How long will it be till we get down there, Blueshell?" Blueshell rolled nervously back and forth across the ceiling. The Scrotoriders had reaction jets. They could maneuver in freefall more adroitly than most humans. Instead, they used stick patches and rolled around on the walls. In a way, it was kind of cute. Just now, it was irritating. At least they could talk. She glanced across the bridge to where Fom Nguyen sat facing the bridge's main display. As usual, all his attention was fixed on the slowly moving stars. He was unshaven, his reddish beard bright on his skin. His long hair floated snarled and uncombed. Physically, he was cured of his injuries. Ship's surgeon had even replaced the muscle mass that Old One's communication equipment had usurped. Fom could dress and feed himself now, but he still lived in a private dream world. The two riders twittered at each other. It was Greenstalk who finally answered her question.
"Truly, we're not sure how long. The quality of the beyond changes as we descend. Each jump is taking us a fraction longer than the one before."
"I know that. We're moving toward the slow zone. But the ship is designed for that. It should be an easy matter to extrapolate the slowing."
Blueshell extended a tendril from ceiling to floor. He diddled with the matte corrugations for a second, and then his voter made a sound of human embarrassment.
"Ordinarily, you would be correct, my Lady Ravna, but this is a special case. For one thing, it appears that the zones themselves are in flux."
"What?"
"It's not that unheard of. Small shifts are going on all the time. That's a major purpose for bottom-lugger ships, to track the changes. We're having the bad luck to run through the middle of the uncertainty."
Actually, Ravna had known that interface turbulence was high at the bottom below here. She just didn't think of it in grandiose terms like zone shifting. She also hadn't realized it was serious enough to affect them yet.
"Okay, how bad can it get then? How much can it slow us?"
"Oh, my."
Blueshell rolled to the far wall. He was standing on starry sky now.
"It would be nice to be a lesser Scrota rider. So many problems my high calling brings me. I wish I could be deep in surf right now, thinking on olden memories."
"Of other days in the surf." Greenstalk carried on for him.
"It's not the tide. How high can it rise? It's this storm. How bad can it get? Right now, it is worse than anything in this region during the last 1,000 years. However, we have been following the local news. Most agree that the storm has peaked. If our other problem gets no worse, we should arrive in about 120 days.
"Our other problem?" Ravna drifted to the center of the bridge and strapped onto a saddle.
You're talking about the damage we took getting out of Relay. The ultra-drive spines, right? How are they holding up?
Quite well, apparently. We've not tried to jump faster than 80% of design max. On the other hand, we lack good diagnostics. It's conceivable that serious degradation might happen rather suddenly.
Conceivable, but unlikely, put in Greenstalk.
Ravna nodded. Considering all their other problems, there was no point in contemplating possibilities beyond their control. Back on Relay, this had looked like a 30- or 40-day trip. Now, the boy in the well might have to be brave for a long time yet, no matter how much she wished otherwise. Time for Plan B, then. Time for what someone like Pham Nguyen might suggest. She pushed off the floor and settled by Greenstalk.
Okay, so the best we can plan on is 120 days. If the zone surge gets worse, or if we have to get repairs...
Get repairs where? That might be only a delay, not an impossibility. The rebuilt OOB was supposed to be repairable even in the low beyond.
Maybe even 200 days.
She glanced at Blueshell. But he didn't interrupt with his usual amendments and qualifications.
You've both read the messages we're getting from the boy. He says the locals are going to be overrun, probably in less than 100 days. Somehow we have to help him before we actually arrive there.
Greenstalk rattled her fronds in a way Ravna took for puzzlement. She looked across the deck at Pham and raised her voice a trifle. Hey, you. You should be an expert on this.
You scrotoriders may not recognize it, but this is a problem that's been seen a million times in the slow zone. Civilizations are separated by years, centuries of travel time. They fall into dark ages. They become just as primitive as the pack creatures, these Tynes. Then they get visited from outside. In a short time, they have technology back again.
Pham's head did not turn. He just looked out across the starscape. The scrotoriders rattled at each other, then...
But how can that help us? Doesn't rebuilding a civilization take dozens of years?
And besides, there's nothing to rebuild on the Tynes world. According to the child, this is a world without antecedents. How long does it take to start a new civilization from scratch?
Ravna waved a hand at the objections. Don't stop me. I'm on a roll.
That's not the point. We are in communication with them. We have a good general library on board. Original inventors don't know where they're going. They're groping in the dark. Even the archaeologist engineers of New Yora had to reinvent much. But we know everything about making airplanes and such. We know hundreds of ways of going at it.
Now faced with necessity, Ravna was suddenly sure they could do it.
We can study all the development paths, eliminate the dead ends. Even more, we can find the quickest way to go from medieval to specific inventions, things that can beat whatever barbarians are attacking Yefri's friends.
Ravna's speech tumbled to a stop. She stared, grinning, first at Greenstalk and then at Blueshell. But a silent scrotorider is one of the universe's more impassive audiences. It was hard even to tell if they were looking at her.
After a moment, Greenstalk said, Yes, I see. And rediscovery being so common in the slow zone, most of this may already be worked out in the ship's library.
That's when it happened. Pham turned from the window. He looked across the deck at Ravna and the riders. For the first time since Relay, he spoke. Even more, the words weren't nonsense, though it took her a moment to understand.
Guns and radios, he said.
Ah, yes.
She looked back at him. Think of something to make him say more.
Why those in particular?
Pham Nguyen shrugged.
It worked on Canberra.
Then Dam Blueshell started talking, something about doing a library search. Pham stared at them for a moment, his face expressionless. He turned back to watch the stars, and the moment was lost. Chapter 22.
"Farm?"
he heard Ravna's voice just behind him. She had stayed on the bridge after the riders left, departing on whatever meaningless preparations their meeting had ordained. He didn't reply, and after a moment she drifted around and blocked his view of the stars. Almost automatically, he found himself focusing on her face.
"Thank you for talking to us. We need you more than ever."
He could still see lots of stars. They were all around her, slowly moving. Ravna cocked her head, the way she did when she met friendly puzzlement.
"We can help."
He didn't answer. What had made him speak just now? Then,
"You can't help the dead,"
he said, vaguely surprised at his own speaking. Like eye focusing, the speech must be a reflex.
"You're not dead. You're as alive as I am."
Then words tumbled from him, more than in all the days since relay.
"True. The illusion of self-awareness. Happy automatons, running on trivial programs. I'll bet you never guess. From the inside, how can you? From the outside, from Oldwin's view..."
He looked away from her, dizzy with a doubled vision. Ravna drifted closer till her face was just centimeters from his. She floated free, except for one foot tucked into the floor.
"Dear Fahm, you are wrong. You've been at the bottom and at the top, but never in between." "The illusion of self-awareness? That's a commonplace of any practical philosophy in the beyond. It has some beautiful consequences and some scary ones. All you know are the scary ones. Think. The illusion must apply just as surely to the powers."
"No. He could make devices like you and I."
"Being dead is a choice, Fahm."
She reached out to pass her hand down his shoulder and arm. He had a typical zero-G change of perspective. Down seemed to rotate sideways, and he was looking up at her. Suddenly, he was aware of his splotchy beard, his tangled hair floating all about. He looked up at Ravna, remembering everything he'd thought about her. Back on relay, she'd seemed bright, maybe not smarter than he, but as smart as most competitors of the Cheng Ho. But there were other memories, how Oldwin had seen her. As usual, his memories were overwhelming. As usual, they were mostly unintelligible. Even his emotions were hard to interpret. But he had thought of Ravna a little like a favored dog. Oldwin could see right through her. Ravna Bergschendott was a little manipulative. He had been pleased, amused by that fact. But behind her talk and argument, he'd seen a great deal of goodness, might be the human word. Oldwin had wished her well. In the end, he had even tried to help.
Insight flitted past him, too fast to catch. Ravna was talking again.
"What happened to you is terrible enough, Fahm, but it's happened to others. I've read of cases. Even the powers are not immortal. Sometimes they fight among themselves and someone gets killed. Sometimes one commits suicide. There's a star system, God's Doom, it's called in the story. 1,000,000 years ago, it was in the Transcend. It was visited by a party of the powers. There was a zone surge. Suddenly the system was 20 light-years deep in the beyond. That's about the biggest surge there is firm record of. The powers at God's Doom didn't have a chance. They all died, some to rot and rusted ruin, others to the level of mere human minds."
"Well, what became of those?"
She hesitated, took one of its hands between hers.
"You can look it up. The point is, it happens. To the victims, it's the end of the world. But from our side, the human side... Well, the human Fahm Nguyen was lucky. Greenstalk says the failure of Oldwin's connections didn't do gross organic damage.
Maybe this subtle damage... Sometimes the remnants just destroy themselves, whatever is left."
Fahm felt tears leaking from his eyes.
and knew that part of the deadness inside had been grief for his own death.
Subtle damage.
He shook his head, and the tears drifted into the air.
My head is stuffed with him, with his memories.
Memories? They towered over everything else. Yet he could not understand them. He could not understand the details. He could not even understand the emotions, except as inane simplifications, joy, laughter, wonder, fear, and icy steel determination. Now he was lost in those memories, wandering like an idiot in a cathedral, not understanding, cowering before icons. She pivoted around their clasped hands. After a moment, her knee bumped gently against his.
You're still human. You still have your own...
Her own voice broke as she saw the look in his eyes.
My own memories.
Scattered amid the unintelligible, he would stumble on. Himself at 5 years, sitting on the straw in the great hall, alert for the appearance of any adult. Royals were not supposed to play in the filth. 10 years later, making love to Cindy for the first time. A year after that, seeing his first flying machine, the orbital ferry that landed on his father's parade field. The decades of space.
Yes, the Cheng Ho. Fom Nguyen, the great traitor of the slowness. All the memories are still there. And for all I know, it's all the old one's lie, an afternoon's fraud to fool the relayers.
Ravna bit her lip, but didn't say anything. She was too honest to lie, even now. He reached with his free hand to brush her hair away from her face.
I know you said that too, Rav. Don't feel bad. I would have suspected by now anyway.
Yeah,
she said softly. Then she was looking him straight in the eye.
But know this, one human to another. You are a human now. And there could have been a Cheng Ho, and you could have been exactly what you remember. And whatever the past, you could be great in the future.
Ghostly echoes, more than memory and less than reason. For an instant, he saw her with wiser eyes. She loves you, foolish one. Almost laughter, kindly laughter. He slid his arms around her, drawing her tight against him. She was so real, he felt her slip her leg between his. To laugh. Like heart massage, unthinking reflex bringing a mind back to life. So foolish, so trivial, but...
I want to come back.
The words came out strangled in sobs.
There's so much inside me now, so much I can't understand. I'm lost inside my own head.
She didn't say anything, probably couldn't even understand his speech. For a moment, all he knew was the feel of her in his arms, hugging back.
Oh, please, I do want to come back.
Making it on the bridge of a starship was something Ravna had never done before, but then she'd never had her own starship before either. They don't call this a bottom lugger for nothing. In the excitement, Fom lost his tie-down. They floated free, occasionally bumping into walls and discarded clothing or drifting through tiers. After many minutes, they ended up with their heads just a few centimeters off the floor, the rest of them angled off toward the ceiling. She was vaguely aware that her pants were flying like a banner from where they had caught on her ankle. The affair wasn't quite the stuff of romance fiction. For one thing, floating free, you just couldn't get any leverage. For another, Fom leaned back from her, relaxing his grip on her back. She brushed aside his red hair and looked into bloodshot eyes.
You know, he said shakily. I never guessed I could cry so hard my face hurt.
She smiled back.
You've led a charmed life, then.
She arched her back against his hands, then drew him gently close. They floated in silence for several minutes, their bodies relaxing into each other's curves, sensing nothing but each other. Then...
Thank you, Ravna.
My pleasure.
Her voice came dreamy serious, and she hugged him tighter. strange, all the things he had been to her, some frightening, some endearing, some enraging, and some she couldn't have admitted, even to herself, till now. For the first time since the fall of Relay, she felt real hope. A silly physical reaction, maybe, but maybe not. Here in her arms was a guy who might be the equal of any storybook adventurer, and more. Someone who had been part of a power.
Fom, what do you think really happened back on Relay? Why was Old One murdered?
Fom's chuckle seemed unforced, but his arms stiffened around her.
You're asking me? I was dying at the time, remember? No, that's wrong. Old One, he was dying at the time.
He was silent for a minute. The bridge turned slowly around them, silent views on the stars beyond.
My God-self was in pain, I know that. He was desperate, panicked. But he was also trying to do something to me before he died.
His voice went soft, wondering.
Yes. It was like I was some cheap piece of luggage, and he was stuffing me with every piece of crap that he could move. You know, 10 kilos and a 9-kilo sack. He knew it was hurting me. I was part of him, after all. But that didn't matter.
He twisted back from her, his face getting a little wild again.
I'm not a sadist. I don't believe he was either.
Ravna shook her head. I think he was downloading. Fom was silent an instant, trying to fit the idea into his situation.
That doesn't make sense. There's not room in me to be superhuman.
Fear chased hope in tight circles.
No, wait. You're right. Even if the dying power figures reincarnation is possible, there's not enough space in a normal brain to store much. But Old One was trying for something else. Remember how I begged him to help with our trip to the bottom?
Yes, he was sympathetic, the way you might be with animals that are confronting some new predator. He never considered that the perversion might be a threat to him, not until...
Right. Not until he was under attack. That was a complete surprise to the powers. Suddenly, the perversion was more than a curious problem for underminds. Then Old One really did try to help. He jammed plans and automation down into you. He jammed so much you nearly died, so much you can't make sense of it. I've read about things like that in applied theology. As much legend as fact. God Shatter, it's called.
God Shatter?
He seemed to play with the word, wondering.
What a strange name. I remember his panic. But if he was doing what you say, why didn't he just tell me? And if I'm filled with good advice, how come all I see inside is...
His gaze became a little like days past.
Darkness. Dark statues with sharp edges crowding.
Again a long silence. But now she could almost feel Fom thinking. His arms twitched tight, and an occasional shudder swept his body.
Yes. Yes. Lots of things fit. Most of it I still don't understand, never will. Old One discovered something right there at the end.
His arms tightened again, and he buried his face against her neck.
It was a very personal sort of murder the perversion committed on him. Even dying, Old One learned.
More silence.
The perversion is something very old, Ravna. Probably billions of years. A threat Old One could only theorize before it actually killed him. But...
1 minute. 2. Yet Fom did not continue.
Don't worry, Fom. Give it time.
Yeah.
He backed off far enough to look her square in the face.
But I know this much now. Old One did this for a reason. We aren't on a fool's chase. There's something on the bottom in that Straumer ship that Old One thought could make a difference.
He ran his hand lightly across her face, and his smile was sad where there should have been joy.
But don't you see, Ravna? If you're right, today may be the most human I'll ever be. I'm full of old ones' download, this god-shatter. Most of it I'll never consciously understand, but if things work properly, it will eventually come exploding out. His remote device, his robot at the bottom of the beyond.
No. But she made herself shrug. Maybe, but you're human, and we're working for the same things, and I'm not letting you go.
Ravna had known that jump-starting technology must be a topic in the ship's library. It turned out the subject was a major academic specialty. Besides 10,000 case studies, there were customizing programs and lots of very dull-looking theory. Though the rediscovery problem was trivial in the beyond, down in the slow zone almost every conceivable combination of events had happened. Civilizations in the slowness could not last more than a few thousand years. Their collapse was sometimes a short eclipse, a few decades spent recovering from war or atmosphere bashing. Others drove themselves back to medievalism. And of course, most races eventually exterminated themselves, at least within their single solar system. Those that didn't exterminate themselves, and even a few of those that did, eventually struggled back to their original heights. The study of these variations was called the applied history of technology. Unfortunately, for both academicians and the civilizations in the slow zone, true applications were a bit rare. The events of the case studies were centuries old before news of them reached the beyond, and few researchers were willing to do field work in the slow zone, where finding and conducting a single experiment could cost them much of their lives. In any case, it was a nice hobby for millions of university departments. One of the favorite games was to devise minimal paths from a given level of technology back to the highest level that could be supported in the slowness. The details depended on many things, including the initial level of primitiveness, the amount of residual scientific awareness, or tolerance, and the physical nature of the race. The historians' theories were captured in programs whose inputs were facts about the civilization's plight and the desired results, and whose outputs were the steps that would most quickly produce those results. 2 days later, the four of them were back on the OOB's bridge. And this time, we're all talking.
So, we must decide what inventions to shoot for. Something that will defend the Hidden Island Kingdom.
And something Mr. Steele can make in less than 100 days, said Blue Shell. He had spent most of the last 2 days fiddling with the development programs in OOB's library.
I still say guns and radios, said Fum.
Firepower and communications. Ravna grinned at him. Fum's human memories alone would be enough to save the kids on Tyne's world. He hadn't talked any more of Old One's plans.
Old One's plans. In Ravna's mind, those were something like fate, perhaps good, perhaps terrible, but unknown for now. And even fate can be weaseled.
How about it, Blue Shell? She said. Is radio something they can produce quickly from a standing start?
On New Yora, radio had come almost contemporary with orbital flight, a good century into the Renaissance.
Indeed, my Lady Ravna, there are simple tricks that are almost never noticed till a very high technology is attained. For instance, quantum torsion antennas can be built from silver and cobalt steel arrays, if the geometry is correct. Unfortunately, finding the proper geometry involves lots of theory and the ability to solve some large partial differential equations. There are many slow zoners who never discover the principle.
Okay, said Fum. But there's still a translation problem. Yefri has probably heard the word cobalt before, but how can he describe it to people who don't have the referent? Without knowing a lot more about their world, we couldn't even describe how to find cobalt-bearing ore.
That will slow things down, Blue Shell admitted. But the program accounts for it. Mr. Steele seems to understand the concept of experimentation.
For cobalt, we can provide him with a tree of experiments based on descriptions of likely ores and appropriate chemical tests.
It's not quite that simple, said Greenstalk. Some of the chemical tests themselves involve search test trees, and there are other experiments needed to check toxicity. We know far less about the pack creatures than is usual with this program.
Fom smiled. I hope these creatures are properly grateful. I never heard of quantum torsional antennas. The Tynes are ending up with comm gear that Cheng Ho never had. But the gift could be made. The question was, could it be done in time to save Yefri and his ship from the woodcarvers? The four of them ran the program again and again. They knew so little about the pack creatures themselves. The hidden island kingdom appeared fairly flexible. If they were willing to go all out to follow the directions, and if they had good luck in finding nearby sources for critical materials, then it looked like they might have limited supplies of firearms and radios inside of 100 days. On the other hand, if the packs of Hidden Island ended up chasing down some worst-case branches of the search trees, things might stretch out to a few years. Ravna found it hard to accept that no matter what the four of them did, saving Yefri from the woodcarvers would be partly a matter of luck. Sigh. In the end, she took the best scheme they could produce, translated it into Somnorsh, and sent it down. Chapter 23 Steele had always admired military architecture. Now he was adding a new chapter to the book, building a castle that protected against the sky as well as the land around. By now the boxy ship on stilts was known across the continent. Before another summer passed, there would be enemy armies here trying to take, or at least destroy, the prize that had come to him. Far more deadly, the Star People would be here. He must be ready. Steele inspected the work almost every day now. The stone replacement for the palisade was in place all across the south perimeter. On the cliffside overlooking Hidden Island, his new den was almost complete. Had been complete for some time, a part of him grumbled. He really should move over here. The safety of Hidden Island was fast becoming illusion. Starship Hill was already the center of a movement, and that wasn't just propaganda. What the Flenser embassies abroad called the Oracle on Starship Hill was more than a glib liar could dream. Whoever stood nearest that oracle would ultimately rule, no matter how clever Steele might be otherwise. He had already transferred or executed several attendants, packs who seemed just a little too friendly with Omdi Yefri. Starship Hill. When the aliens landed, it had been heather and rock. Through the winter, there'd been a palisade and a wooden shelter. But now construction had resumed on the castle, the crown whose jewel was the starship. Soon this hill would be the capital of the continent and the world. And after that, Steele looked into the blue depths of the sky. How much further his rule extended would depend on saying just the right thing, on building this castle in a very special way. Enough dreaming. Lord Steele pulled himself together and descended from the new wall along fresh-cut stone stairs. The yard within was 12 acres, mostly mud. The muck was cold on his paws, but the snow and slush was confined to dwindling piles away from the work routes. Spring was well advanced, and the sun was warm in the chill air. He could see for miles out over Hidden Island all the way to the ocean and down the coast along the fjord country. Steele walked the last 100 yards up the hill to the starship. His guards paced him on either side, with Shrek bringing up the rear. There was enough room that the workers didn't have to back away, and he had given orders that no one was to stop because of his presence. That was partly to maintain the fraud with Omdi Yefri, and partly because the movement needed this fortress soon. Just how soon was a question that gnawed. Steele was still looking in all directions, but his attention was where it should be now, on the construction work. The yard was piled with cut stone and construction timbers.
Now that the ground was thawing, the foundations for the inner wall were being dug. Where it was still hard, Steele's engineers were injecting boiling water. Steam rose from the holes, obscuring the Wendlesses and the diggers below. The place was louder than a battlefield, Wendlesses creaking, blades hacking at dirt, leaders shouting to work teams. It was also as crowded as close combat, though not nearly so chaotic. Steele watched a digger pack at the bottom of one of the trenches. There were 30 members, so close to each other their shoulders sometimes touched. It was an enormous mob, but there was nothing of an orgy about the association. Even before woodcarver, construction and factory guilds had been doing this sort of thing. The 30-member pack below was probably not as bright as a threesome. The front rank of 10 swung mattocks in unison, carving steadily into the wall of dirt. When their heads and mattocks were extended high, the 10 members behind them darted forward to scoop back the dirt and rocks that had just been freed. Behind them, a third tier of members hauled the dirt from the pit. Making it work was a complicated bit of timing. The rock and dirt was not homogeneous, but it was well within the mental ability of the pack. They could go on like this for hours, shifting first and second ranks every few minutes. In years past, the guilds jealously guarded the secret of each special melding. After a hard day's work, such a team would split into normally intelligent packs, each going home very well paid. Steele smiled to himself. Woodcarver had improved on the old guild tricks, but Flenser had provided an essential refinement, actually a borrowing from the tropics. Why let the team break up at the end of a work shift? Flenser work teams stayed together indefinitely, housed in barracks so small they could never recover their separate pack minds. It worked well. After a year or two, and with proper culling, the original packs and such teams were dull things that scarcely wanted to break away. For a moment, Steele watched the cut stone being lowered into the new hole and mortared into place. Then he nodded at the white jackets in charge and walked on. The foundation holes continued right up to the walls of the starship compound. This was the trickiest construction of all, the part that would turn the castle into a beautiful snare. A little more information via Omdi Yefri, and he would know just what to build. The door to the starship compound was open just now, and a white jacket was sitting back to back in the opening. That guard heard the noise an instant before Steele. Two of its members broke ranks to look around the side of the compound. Almost inaudibly, there came high screams, then honking attack calls. The white jackets leaped from the stairs and raced around the building. Steele and his guards weren't far behind. He skidded to a stop at the foundation trench on the far side of the ship. The immediate source of the racket was obvious. Three packs of white jackets were putting a team's talker to the question. They had separated out the verbal member and were beating it with truncheon whips. This close, the mental screams were almost as loud as the shouting. The rest of the digger team was coming out of the trench, breaking into functional packs and attacking the white jackets with their mattocks. How could things get so bloody screwed up? He could guess. These inner foundations were to contain the most secret tunnels of the entire castle, and the even more secret devices he planned to use against the two legs. Of course, all of the workers on such sensitive areas would be disposed of after the job was done. Stupid though they were, maybe they had guessed their fate. Under other circumstances, Steele might have backed off and simply watched. Failures like this could be enlightening. They let him identify the weaknesses in his subordinates, who was too bad and too good to continue in their jobs. This time was different. Omdi and Yefri were aboard the starship. There was no view through the wooden walls, and surely there was another white jackets on guard within, but even as he lunged forward, shouting to his servants, Steele's back-looking member caught sight of Yefri coming out of the compound. Two of the pups were on his shoulders, the rest of Omdi spilling out around him. "Stay back," he yelled at them. And in his sparse somnorsh, "Danger! Stay back!" Omdi paused, but the two legs kept coming. Two soldier packs scattered out of his way. They had standing orders, never touch the alien.
Another second, and the careful work of a year would be destroyed. Another second, and Steele might lose the world. All on account of stupidity and bad luck. But even as his back members were shouting at the two legs, his forward ones leaped atop a pile of stone. He pointed at the teams coming out of the trench. "Kill the invaders!" His personal guards moved close around him as Shrek and several troopers streamed by. Steele's consciousness sagged in the bloody noise. This was not the controlled mayhem of experiments beneath Hidden Island. This was random death flying in all directions, arrows, spears, mattocks. Members of the digger team ran about, flailing and crying. They never had a chance, but they killed a number of others in their dying. Steele backed away from the melee toward Yeffrey. The two legs were still running toward him. Omdi followed, shouting in Somnorsh. A single mindless team member, a single misaimed arrow, and the two legs would die and all would be lost. Never in his life had Steele felt such panic for the safety of another. He raced to the human surrounding him. The two legs fell to his knees and grabbed Steele by a neck. Only a lifetime of discipline kept Steele from slashing back. The alien wasn't attacking, he was hugging. The digger team was almost all dead now, and Shrek had pushed the surviving members too far away to be a threat. Steele's guards were securely around him, only 5 or 10 yards away. Omdi was all clumped together, cowering in the mind noise, but still shouting to Yeffrey. Steele tried to untangle himself from the human, but Yeffrey just grabbed one neck after another, sometimes two at a time. He was making burbling noises that didn't sound like Somnorsh. Steele trembled under the assault. Don't show the revulsion. The human would not recognize it, but Omdi might. Yeffrey had done this before, and Steele had taken advantage even though it cost him. The mantis child needed physical contact. It was the basis for the relationship between Omdi and Yeffrey. Similar trust must come from letting this thing touch him. Steele slid a head and neck across the creature's back the way he had seen parents do with pups down in the dungeon laboratories. Yeffrey hugged him harder and swept his long, articulate paws across Steele's pelt. Revulsion aside, it was a very strange experience. Ordinarily, such close contact with another intelligent being could only come in battle or in sex, and in either case there wasn't much room for rational thought. But with this human, well, the creature responded with obvious intelligence, but there wasn't a trace of mind noise. End of Side 7. To continue, turn the cassette over.